All right, class, we're back. This is Optimus Fields, and we're at block height 633,105, and the price currently is 9,815. Take it away, Nick.
A quick shameless show before we start. Go check out dig.com/Bitcoin, dig spelled D-I-G-G, for the best content. I curate most of the stuff on there, but anyone can submit and contribute to it as well. You can even write your own articles and eventually get paid via the Lightning Network. So if you want to get paid in Lightning and learn more about Bitcoin, I definitely recommend checking it out. But anyways, welcome everyone back to class. And today our special guest is Coinicarus, host of the Fun with Bitcoin podcast. Me and Optimus have both been guests on his podcast, so go check them out, as well as the other great content he has, including my personal favorite, the Lightning Roundtables, which has a bunch of different Lightning developers talking about their current projects. So what's up, Coinicarus? Thanks for joining us.
Thank you guys so much for having me. This is the second time. The first time was last week. Got to join the roundtable, so I'm definitely humbled to be here, man. I really appreciate it, guys.
No worries, bro. I just want to give you a shout out for being the first podcast that I jumped on and just like really got me out of the box and in an indirect way got me involved in the community. And so for that, I thank you, Coinicarus. So peace to that, man.
Oh, man, it's absolutely my pleasure. You know, when you mention a red pill story that involves Dave Chappelle, I can't turn that down, you know? Okay, I just can't.
Yeah, I feel that. So I was listening to some of the episodes, and OX Tail said that to have some continuity on the show, we should ask this question to all our guests. And so I've heard this story before, so you don't have to go like full into the whole story, but just a little quick synapse, because it'll go into the next question. But what attracted you to Bitcoin at first, and how did you first find Bitcoin?
Okay, so I came to it from the medium of exchange. The medium of exchange. So for me, it was really about use. I had no idea about Bitcoin valuation. I honestly couldn't shit about it. And for me, it was just money to use on the internet. So that's exactly I really truly came to it at that way, and I can't tell you how many bitcoins I've wasted. Leave it at that.
Yeah, I feel your pain. So the reason I wanted you to bring that up is because the first question that we got here is, I know you have a tech background, and one of the things that is like a common theme and occurrence is that a lot of people with tech backgrounds will come into Bitcoin, but they will fundamentally miss like the first principles of Bitcoin, and they get lost in shitcoinery. So if you can get in a little bit on that, and then we can start this conversation.
Okay, cool. So yeah, my background is actually network administration, but from there, I ended up having to specialize because what happened was that going way back, because I'm old, okay, so essentially, when 9/11 happened, all the jobs dried up for us. And so I then had to pivot and go into something a little bit different, which is access control, which is not relating to Bitcoin in any way, but has a lot to do with government and security and the way in which we move around society and essentially tracking, okay? So, you know, it's like you're very close to all that stuff. And so I'm surrounded by a lot of really, really sharp engineers that work on really complicated mission-critical stuff, okay? So what you'd think that, you know, you'd show up and start explaining to these guys about, you know, internet money and, you know, self-sovereignty and, you know, being able to be your own bank. And I kid you not, the first reactions I got were mostly laughter, because they just were like, okay, yeah, we've heard about this and it's bullshit. And I was kind of surprised, right? Because they're techies, like they're techs. Like you'd think that you'd be interested by this. And the kind of arguments that I get back from these people are like, one of the smartest guys that I know actually said to me, well, look, the FDIC doesn't insure it. I'm like, that's not that's a terrible argument. Like, I go, do you realize that the FDIC has to insure your money because it's so shit? Like, you realize, like, that's not a feature, you know, like that's a problem that they're trying to solve. So they're putting this Band-Aid. Anyways, it gets very difficult. Because you think, you know, that these people are so smart and, you know, tech savvy, but yet because they know so much about technology, they miss exactly what you said. They miss the first principles of Bitcoin. Like, they're not even thinking about self-sovereignty. They're not thinking about, you know, being your own bank. They're not thinking about decentralization, any of that. They're just looking at it like a technology.
Interesting. So you think they miss it because they have like a fundamental lack of knowledge in economics?
I think that essentially, because all of us are, and I'm, you know, big shout out to Citizen Bitcoin, you know, default Keynesians, mm-hmm. you know, that's what it is. Like, every single one of us went to school and we were all taught the exact same economic system, you know, while the government goes and controls, you know, how the money gets into the system. And we have this, you know, this entity called the Federal Reserve, which goes and, you know, lends the money to the U.S. government. And none of us really think about it. So it's just a given. And so these people, they're really just looking at it like a technology, and they are not looking at it as a form of money. And again, I feel bad because I'm generalizing. There's a lot of technical people that do get Bitcoin, but it's just interesting that when you fall into a sect of people that are technically capable and programmers, and just it totally goes over the head and they think it's funny.
Interesting. So here's another like baby question. Do you think that like coming to Bitcoin as like a quote unquote blank slate, like many of us do, is more of a positive because we don't have like fixed thoughts on Bitcoin or technology and computer science?
That's a double-edged sword.
Right.
I'd say yes and no. There's nothing more beautiful than coming to something and not having any preconceived notions about it and just being full of wonder. You know, there's a saying like the wonderment at the forces of nature is the beginning of wisdom. And it's true, because you really do have to be full of wonder in order to be able to explore and in order to be humble enough to actually be able to absorb the information. So on one side, absolutely, I think it's really great. You know, if you come to it with a blank slate. But on the other hand, I can tell you, coming from a technical background and looking at Bitcoin and realizing how complex it was, it kind of felt overwhelming. So, but at the same time, I also knew that I had enough of a base that I could get started. So I don't know. I you know what? I don't have the point of view from the blank slate. So you guys got to tell me, like, what, you know, how is that mountain to climb? Like,
yeah, I mean, personally, like, coming from, you know, completely green and not knowing anything in the space, it is daunting to try to figure out, you know, like a new paradigm of economics, and then trying to understand computers when, like, I can use a computer and I'm pretty savvy on a computer, but when it comes to like coding and stuff on the back end, it's like a foreign language to me, and I just like throw my hands up and I'm like, yeah, like, this isn't for me. But now that I'm learning and I'm, you know, interested in it, it's like I can sort of read some code, and I don't really know everything that's going on, but I'm able to like at least look at some command line and be like, oh, okay, like I think I kind of get a grasping of what's going on. So, but I feel like I could have maybe sidestepped some of the shitcoinery if I had a little better grasp on it, but let's see what Nick says.
I agree with a lot of what you just said. A lot of stuff looks super intimidating, and some can be intimidating depending on how, you know, your learning style is and how like committed and devoted you are to learning it. But I've learned that a lot of this stuff is not as scary and intimidating as you think. Like, just putting, you know, hard work and effort into it to like actually learn and study and have, especially it's a lot easier when someone like people on Bitcoin Twitter are there to like, you know, hold your hand through it and like guide you through it. It makes things a lot easier. And learning Bitcoin can definitely be somewhat easy, but, or I should say easier, because it is hard and difficult and there's so many things you have to understand.
Maybe it depends, right, on the path that you take. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, it, you know, if you're just going to get into Bitcoin and, you know, maybe have yourself a, you know, hardware wallet and, you know, you're going to use some type of KYC, you know, exchange, you know, like that to, you know, accumulate your Bitcoin, chances are, I think the process for you overall is going to be really easy. I don't think it's going to be too difficult. But I think that if you're going to get into doing the, you know, setting up the Lightning nodes, and, you know, balancing your channels and doing all that, I mean, all of it is getting much easier, right? The user experience is getting much easier. You shouldn't really have to be consciously doing all of this. So, you know, slowly but surely, all of this is getting baked into this. And, you know, if any of you guys run something like a, you know, like a Mynode or a Raspi Blitz, you know that, you know, these things have tons of features on them. And it's just like, I call them the, you know, the Swiss Army knife of Bitcoin. You know, it's like the Bitcoin operating systems. So I think that it really does depend on the path that you take, will depend on the complexity. And then, of course, there's, you know, the people who decide to actually dig into the code and contribute to Bitcoin or contribute, you know, to the Lightning Network, which totally props to them, because we wouldn't, you know, we really wouldn't be here at this juncture if all these people weren't coming together to write this code and, you know, collaborating.
Eventually, I feel like we're going to get to a point in Bitcoin where it's going to kind of be like, you know, using your email or like even, you know, the US dollar, people will just trust it and they won't, you know how it works. Like a lot of people don't know how their car works, how their email works, you know, exactly how a toaster works, but it works. And that's the main thing that's important.
That's right. A person, you know, you got to remember, right? At the end of the day, most people, you know, whether they want to admit it or not, most people are lazy. And they like they like predictability and they like easy things, right? The same way that money flows to the path of least resistance. Well, it's the same thing with a person. You know, a person is just going to take the path of least resistance. So if you make something incredibly difficult for them to get to, the average person is not going to muddle through it. Whereas, you know, if you make it simple enough for them and they don't feel this friction in using the platform or using the product, then it becomes much easier to win. I mean, you know, when I first started getting online, like way back in the day, you know, and like using a dial-up modem and like having, it was like, I think my first modem was a like a 33K or something like that, 33 kilobits per second. I mean, you couldn't download an image in less than 5 minutes. Like a JPEG, you know, or something like that. So it was a terrible user experience, man. You know, you'd get on and you were just this bored loser waiting for stuff to download, you know? So.
Yeah, a lot of parallels to us right now, huh?
Right?
Bunch of bored losers. I had this thought today of how like hodling is boring. And that's why like a lot of people overlook it, because, you know, like how you said the other day, like saving isn't sexy, or you said that on your pod with Nick, like saving isn't sexy. So like, you know, it's delayed gratification. So you don't really see the effects until later. And so, you know, like I was just thinking earlier of like, wow, yeah, you know, like hodling is kind of boring. Like no wonder we just shitpost on Twitter and just try to make each other laugh and read cool articles and just like have fun with our friends. But I wanted to ask Coin Icarus about his background in skating, because I also grew up skating and surfing, and I find it cool how there's like a certain parallel to the Bitcoin HODL culture and the skating culture. So would you mind getting into that, Coin Icarus?
No, not at all. I love talking about that. And it's interesting, right, that to draw those parallels. I think when last week we were discussing this even a little bit with, you know, with Surfer Jim as well. But essentially, so skateboarding, as a kid, right, you're, for the most part, okay, so because I'm 41, you know, like, for me, I skateboarded back in, like, the, I started in, we'll say, like, the late 80s.
Okay.
So boards were like total garbage, and, you know, like, people had just begun ollieing and stuff like that. And, you know, it, anyways, skateboarding was still definitely just like a hobby. No one was really making, you know, big money from it. It wasn't much of an industry. And, anyways, it wasn't like, you know, the kids that were good at team sports, which was like the average kid, like, they didn't skate usually. You know, like, usually the kids that skated tended to be a little bit loners, tended to be, the way I saw it anyways, was more self-driven. You know, like, I can absolutely work in a team. I love to cooperate, but I love to push myself. And although I know you can totally push yourself when doing a team sport, I felt something a little bit more gratifying about skateboarding. It was really all you. And it's a lot of perseverance. It's a lot of failure. And unlike when you don't catch a ball in baseball and the ball just drops and everybody makes fun of you because you suck, well, in skateboarding, what happens is that you fall down the stairs and you smack your face on the pavement.
And it hurts.
So, and it hurts and it burns. And you get up and you do it again. and that's it, you know? Like, and you do it again until you stick it and you roll away. Like, there's a certain amount of, like, it's kind of like, I mean, eventually, what is it? It's like a bit of an addiction, not to adrenaline, but to norepinephrine, which is like a, you know, like a drug that's released. I probably pronounced it wrong, but it's a chemical that's released in your brain when you, you know, like when you hurt yourself, like, you know, when you have a bruise and you like to push on the bruise and it gets numb. So anyways, like that's what's happening. So, you know, from the pain of skateboarding, but the whole point of this is that you push yourself. And you find yourself kind of, at least for me anyways, alone, you know, like I didn't meet a whole bunch of other people to skate with until much later in, you know, like in my skateboarding life and actually have a team. Well, the same kind of thing happened to me in Bitcoin. I came to it completely alone. I just needed a medium of exchange. And I had heard about this thing multiple times and I was like, let's give this thing a shot. So it was, you know, the same type of thing for skateboarding is that, you know, it's, I you're just, to me anyways, I was completely alone and I had to push myself. So I find that there's those parallels, especially, and as well, there's also even a bit the adrenaline aspect, because anybody who actually, you know, if you hold Bitcoin and you really, you know, you really believe in what it represents and what it's going to be, well, you know, watching those massive green candles, kind of a rush.
and the like fuck you attitude of skating is definitely yeah, the HODL ethos.
Yes, when it comes to the mentality, it's definitely also that kind of like fuck you mentality, which also goes along with kind of fringe culture, right? Because skateboarding, at least so today, right, I think it's way more mainstream and it's not even maybe so cool anymore for anybody to be a skater, but like way back in the day, you know, if you were a skater, you were most likely an outcast. And it's kind of the same thing with Bitcoin today. You know, although I know some people, some of the OGs would think that it's much more mainstream, the reality is that you're still pretty outcasted to a certain extent if you're, you know, if you're like a hardcore Bitcoiner.
Yeah, I would say. Yeah, I agree. I find it funny that you've said that twice, that the full circle of at first computers and when you got into skating, how like it was like a fringe small thing, and now both of those things are worldwide phenomenons. And all we've been saying for a while is that, like, guys, like, if you're listening to this Bitcoin kindergarten in 2020, maybe even 2021 and maybe 2022, like, you're still early, and, you know, the whole world hasn't caught on to it yet. And so, you know, like we all know that skating's, you know, it's like it's a pretty big thing. It's like on TV, like, you know, they weren't doing like 900s in 1980 and stuff like that, and we didn't have these smartphones in our pockets. But like that's like how Nick said, you know, soon Bitcoin will probably be as easy as transacting an email. And so it's just crazy how fast technology and humanity moves. And like, I think we've said this multiple times that Bitcoin's probably going to hit a lot sooner than even we can imagine. And we, a lot of us have think that it's going to come like pretty soon, within a few years. And so like, it might even hit us even faster. And it's just like, it's mind blowing. Like I think I've said this every episode, like it's mind blowing that we're here right now at this moment in time and get to watch this happen.
That's exactly right. You know, we are absolutely at a, you know, a major junction in history, and we're very fortunate to get to see this happen. I know that maybe if you're a boomer, you would disagree, because it means that you're all the issues have, you know, now bubbled back up, and hey, guess what? They're not going away. Like all the mistakes that they've made up until now, this is the culmination of it. You know, it's all just collapsing. So probably for them, they're not so happy right now. But for us, this is a chance to maybe get it right.
Jeez, a lot of pressure, Coinakers. A lot of pressure.
It is, but I mean, it's what's that saying, right? We stand on the shoulders of giants.
Amen.
You know, amen. And so we have a responsibility as well.
Cool. Well, That's just kind of the stuff I wanted to hear from Coin Icarus. And if people are listening to this episode in sequential order, then you may have heard the episode with our friend Anastasia, and she's in the pod, and we'll have her jump in a little bit. But we missed a few of the questions that started that conversation, and so I have a few questions here. These will be like our pre-coiner questions. And the first one is, how do you buy or sell and send Bitcoin? And we've said it a few times. And so there's a lot of ways to acquire Bitcoin. And maybe Nick wants to, Nick, you jump in and start it off a little bit.
So you can buy Bitcoin on exchanges. That's like the most popular and easy way. In the future, you're going to earn it. You can earn it. Their jobs. I know a lot of Bitcoin companies are already paying Bitcoin. I'm sure some small businesses out there paying Bitcoin. I know they do, but because I've seen them posted on Twitter, I just can't think of them off the top of my head. And then the last one is mining. You can mine a block and get the mining reward. And I don't really recommend that because it's not the most profitable. It's really not. And you're better off just buying or, you know, working for it. And yeah, those are the three main ways.
And then sending Bitcoin?
Oh, sending Bitcoin is easy. Like I buy my majority on Cash App. And when I buy on Cash App, I just open up my phone, and I have my phone right here. I'm doing it. I click on Bitcoin, and I literally just hit send or withdraw. I type in the amount of Bitcoin I want to withdraw. I scan the QR code. You can type it in as well. And then you just hit send, and then boom, you're done. Like, it's super simple.
Yeah, and it's like the equivalent of sending an email. You type in the address or the email address you want to send it to, and then you just send the withdrawal of the Bitcoins. And we'll move on to the next one because that's pretty simple. So what does each block represent? And Coinakers had a good representation last week that we didn't record. So you remember what we were saying, Coinakers?
Thinking about it. I think the block represents all of the transactions that came before it. And it also contains the miner reward and the fee.
Perfect. Yeah, so I like to think of it like each block is, like you said, it's like the accounting of each transaction that's happened since the last block. And like you just said, the mining reward is what the miner gets paid to essentially audit that specific block and to make sure that, you know, everything is in order and push the next block in. And you want to add something, Nick?
No, there's not really that much to it. The block is super simple, pretty much. Just all the transactions from the previous block to the current block. And that, you know, about give or take 10 minutes.
Yeah, currently, I think the last block was like, I think it was 10 minutes or something. I see that our current block is at 4 minutes right now, so I'll keep an eye on it over here. But this was another question that Anastasia had, and it's who owns the network and who am I paying when I pay a fee?
The users own the network, and when you pay fees, you're paying it to the miners to secure the network. So there's no, you know, since there's no central authority, the fees to the miners are very important because that keeps them incentivized to keep on mining and securing the network.
Yeah, and then the higher the fee you add to your transaction, the faster it'll probably get accepted into the block. And if you're willing to wait and you put a low fee on it, then your transaction will go through, but it won't go through in, you know, the next block or so. So
yeah, that's one thing a lot of people FUD, that they don't get. Like, people will say, oh, Bitcoin is way too expensive to use, you know, the fees are ridiculous. It's like, okay, then just set your own fee. Like, just choose not to pay a lot and you'll be fine.
Exactly. And then the other question we had is, do people know who I send money to on the Bitcoin network?
That's yes and no. Because, I mean, Bitcoin isn't entirely private. Everyone knows that. I mean, not everyone, you know, new people don't know that, obviously. But it's not entirely private. Your wallet or address is just a bunch of random numbers and letters. It's not going to say Nick or Optimist. So if you look at the blockchain and you look at all the transactions happening, you can see someone send, you know, one Bitcoin, let's say, from wallet A to wallet B, but you don't know who's wallet A or wallet B. But let's say if when I buy coins on Cash App and I withdraw it to my personal wallet, everyone else on the blockchain will see, okay, that's just, you know, someone else sending someone else Bitcoin. But Cash App can look at it and be like, okay, you know, through KYC, we know this customer. That's Nick. That is one of his wallets. So only, like, and if I were to send money to Optimist and he gave me an address, I now know that that's his address. No one else will, but I will. You know what I mean? It's kind of like paying in cash. Like, if you pay in cash, no one else knows that you gave that cash to whoever for a product or service except that other person.
Yeah, that's the beauty and the curse of the Bitcoin network. It's fully transparent, so you know, well, you don't know who everyone is, but you know everything that's going on the network, so no one can do any funny business. And you brought up KYC, so let's explain what KYC is.
KYC is just know your customer. So, like, when I buy on Cash App or, like, Coinbase or whatever, I don't recommend Coinbase, so I'm just using them as a you know, example. They have these laws called know your customer, and these protect and stop money laundering. And pretty much, like, I think I just had to send them like a picture of my driver's license or something and prove that it was actually me buying it, And that's at first when I got into Bitcoin, I was like, okay, that's super understandable. But after a while of going down the rabbit hole, I'm like, eh, that's kind of bullshit. Like, they don't need to know that I'm buying it. You know, they like it doesn't even really matter to them. You know, they're still making profit anyways. And they would probably get more, they'd probably get more business if they were non-KYC. And it's just you're the exchange you buy knows who you are, pretty much. It like there are some websites out there like Bisq, HODL HODL, Bitty, and these are all they like no questions asked. Like if you want Bitcoin, you can just buy it. They don't ask who you are. They don't give a fuck who you are. As long as you got the money, they'll give you the Bitcoin.
Yeah, KYC is a pretty invasive process from the legacy financial system, and we're having a lot of like arguments within the Bitcoin community in regards to buying, as we like to say, non-KYC coins and KYC coins, because you're basically giving up a good amount of your privacy when you do that. But if you're a noob, if you're someone new coming into the space, you may not have the technical chops to acquire Bitcoin without KYC. So it's like a it's trade-offs. It's all about trade-offs and so far.
There's a website that one of the Zoomers showed me. It's called Bitty. And this one, I'm actually impressed with it. It's for European customers. Like, it's like the perfect no questions asked non-KYC exchange. Like, you literally go on their website and they say, okay, either send us, you know, like a bank wire or something. And we'll give you Bitcoin. Like you don't even have to have a an account with them. You can just, you know, click, I want to buy this, you know, as a guest. I don't want to make an account. Like they're based in Switzerland. Like they just don't fucking care about your KYC. Like they don't want to know who you are. And I think that's super cool.
Can you use that with like a VPN or what?
I'm sure you can. The
But
only
your bank?
downside is the oh well the thing is they only accept the Switzerland national currency. I don't know what it's called, and the euro. And then they also accept like Ethereum, but like I'm not a shit coiner, so I don't touch that shit. And I don't want to like you know be sending transactions on the chain and stuff for a shit coin, so I just stay away from it.
All right, we'll move on to the next one. So this was actually two questions that Anastasia had, but I'm gonna connect them. And it's why are shitcoins so bad? And then on that point is why don't we need multiple currencies? And how about Coinakers jump in on shitcoins, cause he's got a little more technical flavor in him.
Cool. So for the shitcoins, at least the majority of them, every single one I've ever looked at, has no real use case for actually existing as a coin. So I always like to use one of my favorite examples, because unfortunately I'm screwed into using it at work, is Civics. If anybody knows about that, that's a shitcoin that's very popular, that is run by scammer Vinny Lingham. So essentially, he created a token, a security token, an identity token, I'm sorry, for his platform, okay, for his identity platform. And all the platform is it's a database with IDs, and it's an API. So you go and develop your software, and your software connects to their database through the API and validates your identity. So you tell me why you would own that fucking coin. Like, why would you hold that coin that has no use? And keep in mind, the company I work for uses this technology. Do you think that we own Civic Coin? Do you think that we have to buy Civic Coin in order to use their crappy API?
The answer is no, people.
U.S. callers. Sorry?
I said the answer is no, people.
Yeah. They accepted U.S. dollars. They didn't accept Civic. And we didn't buy Civic. We don't even exchange the token itself, you know, even through the API. So it's just complete garbage. You know, at the end of the day, shitcoins are an attack on Bitcoin. And what happens is when people validate their use cases and they, you know, they pretend like the technology matters. Oh, you know, the faster transactions, even though it's centralized and shut down any day. What happens is that by grouping shitcoins into Bitcoin, it validates their use case, because Bitcoin is the only one that actually has its own use case. It was designed for one purpose. And unfortunately, when we tag the shitcoins in, they end up getting validated. And to noobs, they'll sit there and they'll get tricked, because they'll get tricked with unit bias, right? Because you can get so many more shitcoins. I mean, wouldn't you love to have 250K of something and it only cost you like $400? You know, and it's just pointless, you know, like, so big deal. You have 250,000 coins that, you know, have no, that have no usage, no usage at all, except for the people pumping their bags.
It's like you said yesterday, you have 250K of Chuck E. Cheese tokens.
Exactly. At the end of the day, that's what they are. They are Chuck E. Cheese tokens, whether, you know, whether people want to accept it or not.
And I think it's a good representation of how, like, shitcoiners will always say that their coin's like faster, or it's got bigger blocks, or what have you. And it's like, yeah, man, well, it's basically a database. Like, of course it's faster, you know, like they're just sending it to themselves and switching a ledger on their own computer.
So why does Bitcoin have the smaller block size? It's in order to keep the decentralization. You can only achieve the type of speeds they can achieve through centralization. Okay? And when the people talk about bigger blocks, this is the one part I always find funny, because I feel like nobody that works with those coins knows anything about networks. I don't even understand, like, how nobody asked these questions. But okay, so there's something out there in the world, okay, which noobs I'm sure are going to find confusing. But there's something called inherent latency, okay? And this occurs on every network all over the world. So when I decide to send a message, let's say I send a packet from North America to China, there's going to be inherent latency in the network. That means that there's going to be a delay that I can do nothing about, right? Like, it's inherent. There's nothing I can do about it. It's going to exist based on the distance. So, anyways, if you have bigger blocks, okay, what do you think eventually happens if you try to do it through true decentralization? Well, eventually what happens is the inherent latency is going to affect those bigger blocks, because the inherent latency is going to affect how quickly you can transfer information across the world. So all these big blocks keep getting full and they keep transferring. So what happens when these big blocks get backed up? They continue to get backed up. And then there's something called propagation time, which is the amount of time that it takes to create the block and move it. So all of these things begin, you know, they all take time and they all add up. So without centralization, those things can't be achieved. And that's exactly what we're trying to get away from.
Beautiful description. And we'll jump into the next part about why we don't need multiple currencies. And it stems down to minimizing economic distortions in our economic calculations. And even if we did have multiple currencies, it would be no different than the fiat system that we're in today, with different countries having their own currency and having someone manipulating that currency for their country. And so the goal of Bitcoin is to have one one measure of economic activity that the whole world can communicate on. And like CoinAcres was just saying, we need the whole world to be able to interact with it. And so Bitcoin has these inherent properties that have been chosen by each individual as being the best money. And here we are. It's working 11 years later, and we have, I'm not going to count, math's hard right now. So we have, you know, friends from all around the world in this room that have converged on this money, and we all value our wealth in Bitcoin, and we can all interact with strangers and friends all around the world with one currency, because now we don't have to have different exchange rates and different, you know, calculation for each part of the globe that we're in. And yeah, that's, you know, it as I said earlier, having one currency minimizes economic distortions.
Yeah. Having multiple currencies is just a giant fucking scam, especially from the fiat. I mean, fiat, and it's, I kind of have trouble deciding who's the bigger scammers, you know, the fiat or the altcoiners or the shitcoiners. I mean, they're kind of all the same, but having multiple currencies is just, it doesn't make sense. It really doesn't. It just messes up economic calculation and makes things harder to be priced in. And it just, I stick away from that shit. There's no reason for it at all.
All right. Well, those are basically the questions that we missed from earlier. And before we move on, the last block that came in was roughly around like 11, 12 minutes right now. So it's not always at 10, but yeah. Anyways, Anastasia, do you want to unmute yourself and maybe go into some more questions? And then everyone, we can just have a conversation with her. And from here on out, you guys, we can all just go. It's not just CoinAcres and us.
Hi guys. So yes, I have a few more questions, and let me know if you're ready.
Yeah, we're ready.
Okay. So the first question is, what are the best resources to learn about Bitcoin? Like any YouTube videos, YouTubers, any books, like websites or even movies?
Yeah, well, I'll start. There's obviously an overload of information out there, but a good place to start for most people is just to go get the Bitcoin Standard, or maybe even the smaller book, like the Little Bitcoin Book or Inventing Bitcoin. Or if you're a little more technically inclined, you can try to dive into Mastering Bitcoin, but that's a lot more technical. Another great place is just signing up to Twitter, Bitcoin Twitter, and trying to, you know, wade through all that. But you have to have a little bit of discernment when you get on Twitter, because you really don't know who's who, and you might get fed a lot of bad information. But yeah, I mean, you guys can come hang out with us on YouTube at Bitcoin Kindergarten, you know, shill our own show. We're doing all right. I don't know. What do you think, Nick?
There's a lot of good podcasts out there. Stefan Lavera, Tales from the Crypt, John Valus's podcast.
Noted.
CoinAcres's podcast, you know. He has that thing of the Lightning Roundtable where he gets like 8 or 9 different Lightning developers, and they just talk about all the dope shit they're doing. And you can go to Dig, like I said in the very beginning. I publish a lot of, it's all good Bitcoin-only content. Dex said in the chat, Bitcoin Audible.
Oh yeah.
Dinesh said 1984, Creature from Jekyll Island, and the Bitcoin Standard.
Ooh,
that's a standard.
Good books. Economics in One Lesson. Joe Rogers Words Project. We got getcoin.io. What's Jameson Lopp's Bitcoin resources? I forget the name of that one. It's like lopp.net/Bitcoin. You could do like GG's 21 lessons. So there's a lot of stuff out there that we can definitely recommend. But yeah, how about the next question? Because we could probably keep going just talking about it.
So the next question, let's say I found a resource by myself. So how do I know that I can trust this resource? And how do I know that the person really knows what he's talking about?
Ooh, well,
that's a good question.
Yeah.
You don't.
Yeah. You kind of have to be very cautious when you get into Bitcoin because there are a lot of scammers out there. I think it was either Optimus or Coin Icarus was saying this yesterday. The nicest people are always going to be the scammers. Like, the more toxic douchebags tend to be the more smarter people, and they tend to, even though it might not seem like it, they want, you know, what's best for you and what's best for Bitcoin. Shitcoiners will, and scammers will be like, hey, I'm going to be super nice to you, so you hopefully buy my shitcoin and pump up my bag so then I can exit scam on you. Bitcoiners couldn't care less if you get into Bitcoin or not right now, because either way, if you get in or not, it's a win-win for them. And if you do get into Bitcoin, it's like they almost kind of want to like delay you a bit, because that gives them more time to accumulate. And if you in they also, well, we also don't want people to rush in and get scammed like some of us have. I've lost some money on scams before in the whole shit coinery in the bull run of 2017, and I don't want other people to go through that, because the mistakes I made were super simple, and it makes you feel good seeing, you know, introducing new people into Bitcoin and not having them get scammed and go through the same shit you had to go through. So long story short, you really can't trust anyone, and you have to do your own research and stuff, you know, think for yourself really, but there are plenty of good people out there to help you along the way, and they're most likely going to be the toxic assholes.
Yeah, we got some good comments in the chat, and Duck says trust your gut, and Joe Rogers said build your foundational knowledge. And so that's basically what I was going to say. It's like, you find a Bitcoiner that you know is solid, and then branch out from him, and then you can decipher information. And so we have like, what's we got? We got bitcoin-only.com. That's a solid website. We have 6102. Is it 6Bitcoin6102?
That's the Bitcoin only site that Dex.
Oh, okay, okay.
And I just want to make a quick mention about that site, okay? Guy that runs that site does a lot of research, okay? Like, even so, when I first started my podcast and I was totally confused and I was still partially shitcoining, like Bitcoiners were, you know, telling him to list my podcast, and he wouldn't, because he's like, look, he's like, even though you're a Bitcoiner now, he's like, you're some of your episodes here, he's like, you know, you talk about shitcoining. I'm like, yeah, I'm like, you know, but I learned, you know, and you can see that the content changed. Anyways, you know, it took like a good over a year, and then I reapplied, and he finally went through. Like, he actually goes, my point is, he actually goes through and checks all of the material himself, and he goes and he questions, you know, the owner of the material and everything. So he really does his research. That site is, I mean, you know, because of the owner, that site is very legit.
That's awesome. One site that we missed is NakamotoInstitute.org. Highly recommend it. You just read everything on that and then get lost in the links, and you'll come out a better person.
That is one of the best sites to start with. Absolutely.
Yeah, guaranteed. Okay, another question?
Yes, so how can people without internet connection can use Bitcoin? Like, let's say right now we can use hard cash in the countries that where people do not have computer or internet connection. How can that be solved in Bitcoin?
Well, technically you don't need just the internet to interact with Bitcoin, but you'd have to be on one side a little more technical. Like, you can use a satellite to receive the blockchain, or you can even use like FM radio, but that gets in like very niche like technical aspects. So one of the best ways is like using like OpenDimes, which would basically be you load up an OpenDime or something similar, and then you literally just hand it off to someone, and then you're passing off the Bitcoins like cash. So there's different avenues that you can go around or work around the internet. But yeah, mainly we're using the internet. But what do you guys think?
Well, like you said, there's mesh networks, right? There's GoTenna. There is an integration with the GoTenna. But to your point, to be able to use Bitcoin without the internet, you do have to be a little bit, you know, you do have to be more tech savvy.
Which we may probably get it should get easier in time, but as of now, you probably have to be a pretty nerdy.
I mean, it's grown a lot. Like, you know, from when it first started, like, you think we're nerdy, but like the people who really got into it, like the cyberpunk geeks that were into it, like not bashing them or anything, but like I don't think I would have got it. I wouldn't not have gotten the Bitcoin as early as I did if it wasn't as simple as really just buying on my phone.
Agreed.
Like the technology has come such a far way, and it's going to still go such a far, I can't speak right now. It's going to continue going, you know, a long way. And I think in 10 years or less, we will be extremely surprised with how well the world has adopted Bitcoin, even in areas where people are like, oh, you can't use Bitcoin here because there's not enough internet, blah, blah, blah. But that always reminds me of that, those like three or four villages in El Salvador who don't have a lot. They probably don't have the best internet connection, yet their entire villages run on Bitcoin.
Yeah. Coinhacker said, nerd is good, but, yeah, people just need a cell phone basically. And, as Joe Rogers put in, he said 60% of the world has internet. So, the world is still onboarding onto the internet, but yeah, you know, if you have a phone, you can probably use Bitcoin.
But think about it, right? We always need an enabling technology. I don't consider that a reason not to use Bitcoin, you know, as a medium of exchange. I just don't, you know, like, I mean, why do I care? Like, why am I living the apocalypse? You know, like, I don't get why is that happening? You know, oh, that's it. You know, the whole fucking world's blacked out and I can't use Bitcoin. Why is that happening? Like, I mean, I'm really sorry, but I think we're having worse issues than Bitcoin. Oh, no. You know, like, I mean, if that's what's happening, then I think I'm screwed in a different way.
I totally agree. And like, that's one of the things that gold bugs always say. They're like, oh, well, what if the internet goes out? You know, we're going to need gold, you know, to transact. It's like, no one is going to use fucking gold in an apocalypse to fucking, I'm not going to walk into a Starbucks, you know, burning up like half, it's got like a car driven through it. Like there's no windows. Like, I'm not going to, you know, walk up there, shave off a little part of a gold bar and pay for something. I'm going to walk in and just, you know, gun blazing, just take whatever I want. Like, there's a lot. The world is going to be a lot different if the internet goes out. And I got a feeling no one's going to be trying to pay for shit.
Yeah, Duck wrote in the chat, it's getting harder and harder to fully get away from the internet. And the whole world digitally connected at this point. So if we don't have the internet, then we're going back into the dark ages, and that's probably a worse thing than our Bitcoins going out.
And then really what I want is guns and ammo and food.
Meat, guns, and ammo sounds chill,
right? Like
All right. Next question then, Anastasia.
So how can I ensure that no one can get into my wallet? And can it, anyone technically get into my wallet?
Ooh.
Say I lose my phone. I do not have a password on it.
Well, that's a good question. So your Bitcoin wallet should have a passcode on it, and so as long as you don't give that up, then they most likely can't transact with your Bitcoins. And also, as long as you can keep your private keys safe, which are your 12 to 24 words that basically get you into your control of your Bitcoins, as long as no one is able to find those, then you shouldn't be hacked or no one can get into your Bitcoins. But there is, Bitcoin's still an emerging network, so there has been a lot of hacks on different exchanges and various wallets. So it's a tricky minefield to walk down. But as long as you secure your words, your private keys, and make sure that no one sees your private information, sort of like trying to keep your social security number away from hackers, then you can be almost 100% confident that your Bitcoins are where you think they are.
Yeah, but let's say I lost my phone and now everything is secured and now I'm buying a new phone. How do I go back to my old wallet?
If you, when you create a wallet, always create multiple backups, like write down your seed phrases in a couple different places. Like I know there, like I think Joe might have bought one and was flexing it on Twitter. It's like a steel one where you like really press into it. I don't know exactly how it works, but
let me jump in. So
yeah,
Anastasia, so whenever you create a wallet on your phone, you're going to get, you know, a series of words that's called your seed phrase. So you definitely want to write those down on a piece of paper and keep that really safe. Okay. Don't tell anybody about it. So let's say that you get a new phone. And I think your question was, how do you get your old wallet onto your new phone?
Yes.
So on your new phone, you could download that same wallet application. And as long as, you know, it's a reputable wallet, you should be able to, what's called, import your old wallet. So you would go through that process of importing those words that you wrote down on that piece of paper, your seed phrase, you would import that. And now on your new phone, it would have your history and your balance of your Bitcoin wallet on the new app on your old phone. And you could just erase it off of the old phone.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like the Bitcoin blockchain will never delete your wallet. Like your address, once it's created, it's there forever. So as long as you have the seed phrases to it, you're golden.
Yeah, you can get them from any Bitcoin interface. So,
and another thing is that Anastasia, let's say that you had a phone that you kept at your house, and then let's say you had a phone that you traveled with. You could have the wallet on both phones and use it. If for some reason you wanted to do that, you could have it on both locations. But if you were, migrating to a new phone, you could absolutely just import the seed phrase to the new device, you know, and of course erase everything off of the old phone.
And that makes more sense.
This kind of also brought up the topic of, of having, I guess, kind of different wallets, right? Like the wallet that I have on my phone is not the wallet that contains the majority of my Bitcoin, you know? That's a different, it's a completely different wallet.
Yeah, most people tend to store their, like I have a little bit of Bitcoin on my phone, and that's Bitcoin I intend on spending. And on, whatever I want to spend it on. But my, like, holding or hodling stack, I keep that offline in a hardware wallet. Just so it's not online and has like no risk or very, very, very little risk of getting hacked.
Essentially, if someone were able to hack your seed, it's like picking out a specific grain of sand on the beach, but it's actually more like a specific atom in the galaxy. It's like really big numbers. It's nearly almost impossible.
Like, and with the chances of like the hacker getting everything right for your exact Bitcoin wallet, like, I feel like it literally is impossible because, like, there's just no chance that it's going to happen. Like, I forgot the exact numbers on it, but, like...
OX just put him in. He says 2 to the 256 or 10 to the 77th power.
Yeah, I don't care how smart you are. You're not solving that.
Yeah, and really big numbers.
Supercomputers can fuck off. Because they're not solving that shit either.
Joe Rogers put a good comment. He said, Bitcoin has never been hacked. Only humans have been hacked. So you're probably... The way you'll most likely get hacked is by being socially engineered and someone, you know, tricking you into doing something that you don't want to do. So like we said yesterday, as long as you're vigilant and you... don't trust someone with your money and you don't, you know, you're pretty kind of paranoid and you think everyone's a scammer and you do, you know, you take your paranoid level as high as you can function with it, then you're going to be safe.
I trust the Bitcoin protocol more than my bank. I'm pretty sure my bank's been hacked multiple times.
Yeah, does that make sense, Anastasia?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Any more questions?
My next question is there a limit to how many blocks there can be?
As in at a certain moment or in like...
Like in a blockchain. Can there be a limit of how many blocks there can be in total or no?
There's only a block every 10 minutes. So that's, well, roughly every 10 minutes or six blocks per hour. So that's the limit. And then that's like kind of what Coin Icarus was saying earlier about the block size. So the limit is theoretically whatever your computer can hold, but we want to minimize the data because we don't want there just to be too much data because then it costs more for us to verify the Bitcoin blockchain. And the more data, the more that costs. And then at a certain point, because every block is a specific amount of data, you know, over time, we're only at year 11 and it's somewhere around like 250 something gigs of data to download. So... In over the years, that's going to be a lot of data. So, theoretically, there is no limit to how many blocks there'll be because if Bitcoin's supposed to last for the next 1,000 years, there's going to be a lot of blocks. And, you know, right now we have 633,117 blocks. So, yeah, as Jessifer says, as high as you can count. So there's no limit to the upper, like, hopefully blocks will go on forever. And as long as our computers can handle it and computers get better, then there's no limit to blocks.
And that makes sense.
Yeah. As Duck said, he says there's only rules to regulate how often blocks occur, but no limit to how many.
Oh, I also always see words that I have not seen before. Like, what do they mean when they say DCA or stack sats or like some other weird terminology I've never heard before?
Okay. Well, DCA stands for dollar cost averaging, which is it's like a known financial technique to investing, but and we in like slang we call it stacking sats. So you just try to acquire as much Bitcoin as you're financially able to. So dollar cost averaging means buying a specific amount of Bitcoin either daily, weekly, or monthly, and you buy the same amount in dollars, and so over time your the median or the average Bitcoin price will like level itself out because you'll minimize your risk to the volatility. So if you buy, say you buy $1,000 one day and then the very next day it dumps, well, if you spread out that $1,000 over a certain amount of days, you'll get the average price within that time. So, excuse me, we call it dollar cost averaging, but now it's taking on a whole new form on Bitcoin Twitter within all of us and all of our friends, and we call it stacking sats. And that's just, accumulating as much Bitcoins or as many Satoshis as you can possibly hold on to. And so it's just kind of begun, like it's turned into a meme of its own where you just try to hodl as many Bitcoins as you can get. And anytime you have dollars, you just stack sats. So.
Stacking sats is a super important meme because it teaches you that you don't have to buy a full Bitcoin. Like Duck said in the chat, you can buy a sat is the term for 1/1 millionth of a Bitcoin, and right now it's 10,183 sats per dollar. So stacking sats is just sats. Every sat is equally as important as any other sat. So you just stack as many sats as you can. It doesn't matter how little or how, big your stack is. Just stack sats and you'll be all right.
Joe Rogers gave us a tweet, his very official Oxford definition of stacking sats, and it's the act of obtaining BTC usually in small denominations such as sats through either purchasing or earning. And then OXTEL put to back that up, he says you don't time buying into a 401k, you just steadily add to it over 30 years. And so that's basically the same ethos. You just, accumulate as much Bitcoin as you can over as long as a period as you want to, and you just make sure that you get more Bitcoins over time. And it's a really good way for average people to own Bitcoin because not everyone has, like tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars sitting around of cash, just sitting around waiting for something to turn it into. So a lot of us just live paycheck to paycheck, and so we modify our behavior to, save a little more in Bitcoin. And so if you just continually save, or as I like to say, sometimes just always buy consistently the Bitcoin ABCs. And the future you will be very happy that you did that.
Are there any other terms that I need to know as well?
Well, there's a lot of terms, so like I don't want to confuse you, but
HODL.
Maybe something that is most commonly used that I definitely need to know.
Yeah, like Nick said, HODL. Nick, explain that one. Oh, here we're getting a bunch of them.
HODL just means hold on for your damn life. Like, if Bitcoin is so volatile, like, not too long ago, a few months ago, Bitcoin went down 50% in one day. Like, imagine losing, quote unquote, losing your value 50% in one day, and then it shoots right back up over time. HODL means just, strap in for this roller coaster ride and don't sell, just keep adding more.
Yeah, random guest put a really good comment, and this is connecting stacking sats and HODL. He says it's trying to get people from trading and thinking that it's too late to get into Bitcoin while Bitcoin is absolutely scarce, so any small amount now will be a big amount later. And so like Nick said, HODL was actually created by like a drunk post where the guy misspelled HODL, and he just, like Nick said, it was just saying, he's like, I'm not a good trader like any of you guys, so I'm just gonna hold it. But he misspelled it, and so in typical Bitcoin fashion, we just, you know, took it and ran with it. And so like random guest said, it's like, you don't want to trade your Bitcoins because you don't want to lose your position. So you just want to HODL your Bitcoins, and you just, you know, stack sats and HODL. You just keep buying consistently and then hold those Bitcoins for as long as you can, because you don't want to miss these giant price rises. Make sense?
Like, from what you said, that everyone should hold to their Bitcoins, how do you actually get people to switch their mentality from being a trader, like thinking, oh, the price goes down and they're like selling it off, selling it, or if the price goes up, they're like, oh, I need to buy it. So like more of an investor mentality, like knowing the real value and start putting little by little over time, and not to trade, to sell it off.
So, like Joe said, you got to get burned to see the light. Nearly all traders in Bitcoin, after a while, they lose so much money, and they're like, okay, you can't really trade this thing without getting too wrecked. I mean, you might pull off some good trades, you might have some success, but like HODL Not said on Twitter the other day, he got into trading, he did pretty well, he thought he was the man, he ended up getting really wrecked, and he now has a lot less Bitcoin than what he originally had, and he has learned, you know, the hard way not to trade and just to HODL. It's kind of like touching your hand to a hot stove one too many times. You learn after a while.
Yeah, Bobo Dread put a good link from Bitcoin Audible, and it's I'm HODLing. So maybe you want to check that out, and you can kind of get into the mindset. And to your question about trying to teach people not to trade and to hold on to Bitcoins, Duck1123 said time preference. And so by that, we mean that a lot of traders just want to get a quick buck and get dollar rich. But once you go down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and you start to understand that you want to hold Bitcoins for as long as you can, then your behavior starts to adjust. And there's a meme that we commonly, and I know for a fact that the majority of us in this room has had this happen to us, where you don't change Bitcoin, Bitcoin changes you. So over time, you just start to adjust your behaviors, and you start to, you know, start calculating every purchase that you have a little differently, because you realize that, well, these dollars, I could spend it on, you know, going out tonight. I could, you know, go to the bar and spend $50 with friends and get real, you know, get pissed drunk and have a good night. But if I can change my time preference and delay a little gratification, well, if I buy Bitcoin with that $50, you know, in a few short years, that $50 will be a lot more. But we're not thinking of it as $50. We're like, well, I can acquire 500,000 sats. And I know that 500,000 sats is going to be a lot. And it's just a common phenomenon that once you start switching your mind state into accounting for your money as Bitcoins instead of dollars, then it'll like, it's just like a click in your brain that'll switch, and you start to realize that, like, okay, if Bitcoin's my money and it's going to go up in price, well, then, you know, our natural greedy mind that is human nature starts to seep through, and you're like, okay, well, I can be a little greedy for myself right now. And if I just buy some Bitcoin and hold on to it and be, you know, get my Scrooge on, then in the future, I'll be able to buy more. And so, yeah, it's like, there's nothing really I could do to tell someone to stop trading unless they get wrecked, unless they put their hand on the stove. And then once they start holding Bitcoin, you start seeing the price rise, and something psychological switches in your brain, and you're just like, oh wow, like this dollar I can buy 10,000 sats. I'm not spending this on some stupid Chinese trinket. Like, I'm gonna buy some Bitcoin. And then in the future it might be $2. Well, the equivalent of buying $2. And so it's an internal process.
I know me myself, like after work, after I got off work, I used to be like, oh my God, I don't want to go home and make dinner with the food I have at home. I'd rather just go pick up some like cheap fast food or some, you know, some bullshit on the way home so I don't have to make anything. And I realized, oh my God, I'm spending so much money on this shit when it's A, not good for me, and B, it's draining my bank account, which could be, you know, going into Bitcoin. And after a while, I stopped going out to eat so much, and I just started eating at home. And not only was I feeling better, but my sat count was going up, and that just made me richer.
Yeah, we have two good comments in the chat. One by Random Guest, and he says, every economic decision is an opportunity cost. I can do this or I can do that. And I measure everything in terms of Bitcoin opportunity costs. And then Jestifer adds, time preference equals how much you value the present versus how much you value the future. So that goes back into hodling and stacking sats, that everything you're buying has a cost now and into the future. You're trading a little bit now versus what future you can do with those dollars or those Bitcoins. And so once you just start thinking in that mindset, then, you know, the price of things starts taking on a whole new life of its own, and you're probably going to start saving.
Which is a good thing, not a bad thing. I know, you know, growing up in this world today where they shove Keynesian economics in your face, you know, these people like to say, oh, don't save, just, you know, buy now, consume as much as you can, take out credit cards, take out, you know, auto loan debts, you know, any other debt, student debt. Saving is good. It really is. And it will fix capitalism as well, because the capitalism we have today is not capitalism, because capitalism is based on people's capital that they've saved up. It's literally in the name. And what we have today is all debt. Like, I don't know the exact, yeah, Dinesh said the best time to spend is during a recession with the throwing up emoji after it. I'm pretty sure, isn't that the shit like people at the Fed were saying, or like Steve Mnuchin or whatever those other scammers are?
I mean, he gave us $1,200 for the next 10 months, bro, to spend you know, circulate throughout the economy, because that's going to make us all richer.
Dude, he's so generous. A whole $1,200? Oh my God. Like, these people running our current financial system are a bunch of fucking idiots. They really are. And I compare them to Satoshi Nakamoto, who was a god. Like,
god amongst men.
He was so ahead of his time to even think of, like, everything about Bitcoin. He made it so perfect, and it's insane. It blows my mind. It's like one of the new wonders of the world, how it was created.
That's actually did you guys see that tweet that Adam Back posted today? Let me see if I can find it real quick. And he had a picture of the Egyptian pyramids, and it went like, the Bitcoin blockchain is the new wonder of the world. More work and human ingenuity than went into the Great Pyramids of Egypt. Said the biggest computation ever done, a digital monument, a verifiable artifact of digital gold, the foundation of a new digital age. And it's like, yeah, man, this is a monolith, you know, like this is the biggest computer brain that the world has ever known, and it just continues to grow. And that was based off because we just hit new all-time high, or was it? It wasn't new all-time highs. We just hit, this is the other tweet that it was quoting. We just hit a cumulative work in the Bitcoin blockchain, surpassing 2 to the 92nd of double SHA-256 hashes, which is an enormous amount of computation power. I think I sidetracked you a little bit, though.
No, you're good.
Yeah, before we get too technical, do you have any more questions, Anastasia?
Yes. Did Bitcoin to you at some point sound too good to be true?
Wait. It definitely It definitely does. It sounds like a scam. When I first heard of it, I thought it was a full-blown scam. OX, what you pretty much said is, what do you tell people when they say, like, oh, it's too good to be true? Because I just said, oh, it's so perfect and amazing. Dinez is right. That's one of the reasons why it takes people so long to get in, because you hear these people preaching that, oh, there's this perfect solution to the system, and you're gonna get rich, and you know, you're gonna get free, blah blah blah, and it only makes sense right away if you're educated on money and what money is, and you know, sound money and hard money, which most people are not. I definitely wasn't. And reading the Bitcoin Standard really helped me understand that.
Yeah, like I wrote one time, Satoshi Nakamoto's genius was domesticating human greed, and Coin Icarus and random guests added to that right now. And Coin Icarus wrote, he understood our incentives were fucked. So that's why it seems like too good to be true, because it's like ironing out all the problems that we see in the world, and we're like, how can this actually work? And then random guest wrote, people respond to incentives, and so like that's where we are right now, responding to the incentives that is Bitcoin. And then he adds, no one is better than their incentives. Bitcoin will leverage inherent human greed for the greater good of humanity. So back to like hodling and stacking sats, Bitcoin has a weird way of hijacking your greed, and it makes you greedy for yourself and for your future self, because you can start to accumulate, you know, some money, accumulate capital, and in time, hopefully do something for the greater good, because as Mises writes, you know, man serves other humans so that he can be served in return. So it seems like it's too good to be true, because it like almost is too good to be true. It's like, okay, how can I be greedy and still be able to benefit myself and indirectly benefit everyone else? Because it's like, as our friend Ayu puts, he's like, I hodl for me, but that helps you. And so as long as you're hodling and you're holding your Bitcoins for the long run, then you're helping everyone else out indirectly, because you know, we see the truth that is Bitcoin, and we understand that Bitcoin can lead us into a better world, and Bitcoin can eliminate all these economic distortions that we're seeing at the moment. And this reminds me of a tweet that Pierre just put out, and he said, hold on, I got it saved. He put it as, he said, there would be far less social unrest if central banks had not created so much artificial inequality. And so that goes back to like the banking system. Our central banks have messed up our money, and like we've said before, fix the money, fix the world. And so that goes back to, this sounds like it's too good to be true, because it's so simple. It's such a simple solution to such a complex problem. It's like, okay, wow, like I just need to save in this new money, and in time the ripple effects will, you know, go out into the world, and things will sort of sort themselves out without us really having to be as hands-on as we think we need to be. So if, you know, it seems too good to be true until you look into the technology behind it and you realize that, wow, like everything actually works how we think it does. And look, since we've talked, there's been 4 blocks that came in. So as the newest way we say it, TikTok next block, as long as these blocks come in, then, you know, over time, like your confidence in the system starts to grow. I can remember when I basically got into Bitcoin, as long as I was seeing Bitcoin blocks come in, like my confidence just kept growing. I would just watch the Bitcoin blockchains like, oh, 10. Okay. Like there's a block, 10 minutes just went by and another block came in. And then, you know, at a certain point, you kind of take it for granted and you're like, oh, yeah, of course, blocks are going to come in. Like, this is Bitcoin. You know, it doesn't stop for anything. And so it seems too good to be true until you just understand that, well, Bitcoin is like it's still going. So, you know, now let me just like get on with my life. Like, you don't have to be a Bitcoin nerd like all of us. You just save in it and understand that your money is still going to be there and your value isn't going to be degraded, and you can just, you know, continue on to your life and try to do some bigger and better things and, you know, build a family or what have you, or just go have fun. And yeah, just Bitcoin is, as long as it keep pumping out blocks, then you'll start to see that, you know, Bitcoin, you don't change Bitcoin, it changes you.
Christopher said something that I really liked. He said, if Bitcoin could be stopped, it would have been stopped because the powers of the world want us to keep living in a debt system. A better money has to be unstoppable. And that's what people like have to understand, is Bitcoin has to be perfect. It has to be this, you know, amazing thing that everyone's preaching, because if not, governments could just stop it like they stopped gold and then put us in a debt system and enslave. Bitcoin has to be able to withstand all attacks against it, and it's done that for the past, you know, 10 years plus now. And not only am I very confident in it, but millions of other people are as well.
It's like I think I told you yesterday, like, as long as you believe in math and you can understand that our math still works, then you can understand that cryptography is just based on math and there's no trickery in it. You can check it for yourself. At a certain point, it like saturates your DNA and you don't think about, okay, do I really trust it? It turns into an inherent trust in the system because you understand it well enough to know that, okay, like it's not going to stop. Like
you kind of think like studying history has taught me, like, throughout history, there's always going to be the rise and fall of different nations and governments. And I am betting on math, you know, the Bitcoin blockchain, to outlast human greed and the governments, the terrible people running us. So math is always going to be around, but those corrupt people in office won't always be. So do you have any more questions, Anastasia?
Or does that alleviate any of your doubts?
I have only my last question is, then what are the cons?
What was that? You broke out a little bit for me.
What are the cons of the Bitcoin? I know that it has only a few transactions, but I believe that is solved by the Lightning. What are other cons of Bitcoins?
How about Coin Icarus? Yeah, I was gonna say, yeah, not many. But if Coin Icarus and some of these other guys want to get technical, they could get a little technical on you.
I didn't understand the question.
It's like, what are the cons to Bitcoin? Like, or are there any Bitcoin like cons about Bitcoin? Because we've just been shilling all the pro side of Bitcoin.
Oh,
What are the cons of Bitcoin? I don't know. I mean, it's
it doesn't have like a long-term history yet. Maybe that could be a con. It's only 11 years old, and like random guest said, what did he say? It's a big hill, or it was Duck. Sorry, it's a big hill to get the network effect. So as of now, like a con is it's very small, and you know, maybe this experiment won't work, and you know, it fails, and who knows what happens into the future, but you know, the future's uncertain. And I'm putting my bets on that Bitcoin's going to continue. So the cons, yeah, I guess the cons could be like what Luke Dash Jr. says. As of now, like we couldn't onboard the whole world. We couldn't onboard 8 billion people onto a Bitcoin base layer, because like you said, there isn't that many transactions. But that's it's not necessarily a con, because if we go up into higher levels, then we only need to use the base layer when we do giant settlements on the blockchain. So that would mean that we're settling, you know, like hundreds of millions of dollars. And so that would happen a lot less often. But us normal people would be interacting on, I don't know, Lightning or say some other layers like that.
I don't know. I think the organic growth that Bitcoin is experiencing is not a con. I mean, I get it that, you know, it's a small network still, and it's growing, and it's an experiment. I mean, realistically, even the Bitcoin core version, right, of the software is still not version 1.0.
Yeah.
So, you know, so we're still very, very early to this game. But I don't really see these things as cons, though, you know, like I try to think of like shitcoiner arguments, you know, that they give, you know, that they give us, you know, like, oh, you know, like Bitcoin is slow and it's a dinosaur. It's like, I don't really see that as a con. I want it to work. If people understood, you know, it's funny, right? Like the fiat system has people fooled into thinking that there's immediate settlement, because you go to the cash register and you get approved on your transaction and you move on with your life, not realizing that those transactions do not take place at that moment. Like that, all that is just it's a flag in a system that eventually gets aggregated at some point later on. Final settlement, even between banks, you know, is not instantaneous. So Bitcoin is much faster and has already beaten, if you really think about it, the big boss there, the BIS, Bank of International Settlements. Bitcoin already does a better job than that. So to me, I just don't, you know, again, I guess this is the wrong audience for cons, you know.
We got a few good comments. Dennis writes, the only con is learning curve, but he says that's also a good thing. So by that he means, like we've been saying earlier, it's a fundamental mind change that a lot of people are going to have to adjust to. So like we said, you don't change Bitcoin; Bitcoin changes you. So like Coin Icarus just said, most people believe that the money they're interacting with is, you know, final settlement. Like when I pass you cash dollars, that's final settlement. But when you buy things on your credit card or debit card, it has up to, I believe, 90 days for you to cancel that and for it to finally settle. So even then, you know, like Bitcoin beats that. And then we have another comment by a random guest. And this goes into your concerns yesterday about the short-term volatility. So that could be looked at as a con, because, you know, if you're trying to buy something tomorrow and you buy some Bitcoins today, you know, we don't know what the price is going to do. So tomorrow, the goods and services you want to buy might cost more in Bitcoin terms. But if, you know, you can lower your time preference, like we were saying, and you can wait a day or so, then it might be more, you know, you might spend less Bitcoins to buy whatever you want to buy. So in the short term, the price can be looked at as a con, but in the long term, like we like to say, number go up. So that's like a term that you'll probably start to get familiar with, and basically, that's just saying that over the 11 years that Bitcoin's been out, the price has appreciated. The price has gone up and to the right. So we just say number go up. And it's a shorthand way of just saying if you hold Bitcoin, if you hodl your Bitcoins, if you stack sats and hodl your Bitcoins, the price will go up. So in the short term, the price may fluctuate, but if you hold it long enough, then you're going to be in the green, and your Bitcoin will buy more than it did the day you bought them. Oh, and we got Bobo Dread. He put lack of privacy is the main con to me. And that's kind of what we were talking about earlier. Like, if you're buying KYC Bitcoins, buying them through an exchange, and you think that Bitcoin is anonymous, and you try to do, like, quote-unquote, some illegal things, then they have a permanent record of you buying these things or knowing where your money is. So that can be looked at as a con, but there's a lot of effort into fixing, well, you know, working around that. So another con that is being worked on. So it just depends what you're using Bitcoin for and what cons or trade-offs you might consider.
I think a lot of people also have to remember is most of the cons in Bitcoin can and will be, you know, fixed. Because since Bitcoin's programmable money, we can just program it and add, you know, layers to it to make it, you know, we can use it however we want. We just got to make new stuff to use it in that way, you know. If privacy is an issue, we can create, you know, second layers to help with privacy.
Like Lightning.
You know, I know Lightning Network can be a solution. State chains can be a solution. I'm sure there's, you know, loads of other stuff that, you know, we can just program.
And this kind of goes full circle, like what Coin Icarus and I were talking earlier about skateboarding and computers. We're so early in this Bitcoin game, in this Bitcoin experiment, that right now some things are a little clunky, some things are a little hard to like wrap your head around. There might be a pretty complicated process to do what you need to do at the moment, but technology moves so quickly that in a short amount of time, I'm convinced that these really, really smart people that are working on Bitcoin will figure this out for us. And that's not to just, you know, pass the baton on to someone else, but it's just how technology works. It's getting better every day, and it's only going to get easier for us to use. So in a short amount of time, like we've been saying, it'll be as easy or close to as easy as using email is today, because back in the day, you know, sending email wasn't as easy as it is today. But now everyone has a phone in their pocket, everyone has email in their pocket, and you're connected to the whole world. So if you can just not be so, I'm blanking on the word, but if you don't have such high time preference, if you're not being impatient, that's what I was looking for, and you can have a little patience then, and just save in Bitcoin, and in a short amount of time, you'll be using Bitcoin to go shopping. I mean, you can do that today, but you can use Bitcoin safely and securely. And so it's only a matter of time until most of these things get fixed and flushed out. Not even fixed, but just get better.
Also, Bitcoin is moving at such a rapid pace. Like, people don't understand. Like, some people may not understand how quick, you know, Bitcoin's actually evolving. You know, kind of like how I wasn't alive for this, but when the internet first started, you know, you listen to Bitcoin Tina, who was super into all this stuff. He, you know, the computers and the internet just came on the scene and just exploded with growth. And money started, you know, flowing into it. And the more money that flows into it, the more opportunity there is, and the more it, you know, gravitates people and sucks people in. And in the beginning stages, that always tends to be the, you know, the smarter people who are willing to you know, put their head down and work day and night to get this stuff right. Like, back to what we were talking about earlier, if you are going to put your money into Bitcoin, you're going to want to make sure that your money is still there and nothing, you know, happens to it. You're going to want to make sure that it's the most secure thing. So even if things do take time, that's not a problem in the slightest. I would much rather things take a few extra months, a few extra years, to, as long as they get it right, because I want to, you know, trust this protocol. I don't want to have, you know, any doubt. I want to be able to, you know, verify everything for myself, not trust it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we don't need to make any quick, rash decisions when it comes to our money. We don't need to mess it up. You know, we all have our life savings in it, or most of us have our life savings in it, and we believe in it. And so we'd rather, as the saying goes, move slow instead of moving fast and breaking things. So, yeah, I'm with Nick on that one. Not to wrap up the discussion, but I think we've been going for, I don't know, at least an hour and a half-ish. So, Anastasia, did we help you out? And
yes, thank you.
Oh, awesome, awesome. Nick or Coinicris, do you guys, what do you guys want to do? Do like a little wrap up, or how about anyone in the chat? You guys, maybe we can talk a little bit. This might be our longest show, but
if anyone in the chat wants to speak up, they can, and say any thoughts or opinions on anything, or ask another question. Ooh. If not, we can just wrap it up.
I think Duck's got a good comment. He says, we're here to fix the money, not break it further. That might be a good way to end it.
But wise. Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, we'll end this, and we'll stay on a little afterwards. So thanks for you guys listening. Thanks for showing up, everyone. This has been another really fun Bitcoin class, Bitcoin kindergarten. So
we had a huge turnout tonight as well, like over 15 at one point.
I know, it's getting popular, man. Thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it. And also, I just want to add, like, this show is as much your guys's as it is ours. Like, me and Nick just host it, and you know, you guys make it happen. You guys make it what it is. So we'll keep getting better, and you guys just keep showing up. And you know, this is a community effort.
Yeah, we really appreciate everyone who comes out and spends a couple hours with us every Thursday. It really means a lot.
All right, peace out, guys. I'm gonna end the recording now.